It's Wednesday, November 5th, 2014, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, journalists here in Missouri and across the country are incensed to learn a no-fly zone over Ferguson was put in place, possibly, to keep the media out. News that hits close to home, KBIA is at the center of two pretty big stories. We'll talk about both the launch of Access Missouri and the station's planned purchase of a second FM frequency. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to as well, but let's start with last night's election results. By now you know a wave of red washed over the country and the state. In Washington, the GOP took 7 seats in the Senate, one more than what was needed to regain control of that chamber. And here in Missouri, the Republicans will now have a veto-proof majority. The impressions you guys had of last night's results?
Well, like we were talking about earlier and before the show came on, is that I think the winners of all of this are the pundits, the pollsters, and the people who put up the money. It's what the pollsters pretty much said it was going to be. They called it for the Republicans. It went the Republicans' way, both in state races as well as nationally. And I think what could be lost in this is that we could have more of the same kind of government that we've had the last 6 years. Even though you have the winners saying, no, we have policies, we have plans, we're going to legislate. But I don't think they have a clear enough majority, especially on the national level, to break up this sort of deadlock that's been going on in Washington.
Well, and there was one other winner there. Those were the local television stations. They made boatloads of money off of all the political advertising, even in states like Missouri, where there weren't any big statewide races going on. A lot of money got spent. And one of the reasons, if you look at some of the analysis back in 2012, during that presidential election, something like four out of every $5 spent in campaigning was spent on local TV. It was 95% this time around. So the local stations made out like bandits by being able to sell all that advertising. Now, it's funny because as we were talking before the show, a lot of folks couldn't wait for those commercials to be over with. Mitch McConnell, in his live address when he was claiming victory last night, even said, I know you'll all be happy that there won't be any more commercials. So maybe they were winners. The TV stations were winners in the short run, but how much more of this can we stand?
Yeah, I guess the thing that really bothered me was that we didn't see much of it here in Missouri, but in other states like Florida and Illinois and Colorado and others. I mean, just the level of fear and hatred on some of these commercials were just incredible. I mean, if you weren't fearful of someone taking your gun, you were fearful of someone who's not going to allow you to have a gun, or just name an issue. And that's all you saw over and over and over again. But I think the one thing that people really realized that toward the end was that this was all about the president. Every commercial that came out, if it was on a Democratic side, you didn't hear about the president, even though he's the leader of the Democratic Party. On the Republican side, that's all you heard about was Republican. Didn't matter whether you were running for dog catcher or for senator, Obama was linked to every one of those commercials.
Well, and even here in mid-Missouri, we would see that in commercials in the 47th district race in the state house, that our state legislature didn't really have a whole lot to do. In fact, went out of its way not to have anything to do with the Affordable Care Act or Obama's policies in that realm. Yet that was still cornerstone in one of Chuck Basie's commercials against John Wright.
And I do think it's true. I mean, they wouldn't spend the money if on average those kinds of commercials don't work. But it doesn't always work. I mean, look at that judgeship down in Jefferson City, the circuit judge position. Republican groups spent, I think, $400,000 on that campaign, most of that on TV. Those crazy psychedelic ads.
Yes.
And it didn't work. She won re-election. So it doesn't always play out the way they think it's going to.
The one thing that I'm going to be interested in, now we've sort of gone past the midterms, and now we're going to start talking about the 2016 presidential election.
Yes, because that campaign started about an hour ago.
Yeah, about an hour ago. And, you know, now I'm really going to be interested to see how much money is going to be spent. And is that money going to be spent in television ads? Yes, it's going to happen. I think the numbers that Mike gave are going to go up. But I'm also going to be interested in seeing how much of that's going to be spent in social media, how much of that is going to be spent on grassroots, on the ground campaigns, which is what the Obama campaigns, both in 2008 and 2012, are known for. So it's going to be interesting to see where all this money, which is now flowing in because of the Supreme Court decision, where is that going to go? On a nationwide scale.
You know, one thing I was happy about in watching the television coverage, and I tended to watch mostly CNN and Fox just to kind of see how they compare them, not a lot of the gee whiz stuff anymore. I mean, there was a lot of in-your-face graphics, but it was mostly—
There was a virtual Senate thing on CNN.
What I really liked, he's been getting better and more airtime as John King at CNN. That guy knows every single precinct in every single state and can sit there and predict very accurately what's going to be happening in those contests. And for somebody who's a political junkie, at least, that was really interesting.
I mean, but that goes back to what I was saying earlier. I mean, the pollsters— they have really fine-tuned elections. I mean, they pretty much know weeks ahead of the election what's going to happen because they have an idea of what the turnout is going to be.
And their research is so good based on what they've been able to do there. Well, there were thousands of hours of live television coverage produced last night, and there were bound to be some bloopers along the way. Maybe you caught this one on MSNBC.
We were just talking here off the air about a lot of this is all about 2016, about how they get to the White House the next time. That's the big prize in Washington. And there have been a lot of Republican senators who have hoped that Mitch McConnell will. Could that be me?
No, it's not you. It's something ambient.
No, I'm afraid it is, unfortunately. The alarm goes off, and there you are.
I thought you were a fire.
Yeah. Yes, I will remember to bring home the milk and don't worry about it. And I'll feed the dog in the morning. Just sleep in. It's going to be okay.
So, Ernest, is the show open was rolling today as we were getting ready to do the show? I saw you reach into your pocket, turn off your phone. Apparently, you're one step ahead of Tom Brokaw.
Yes.
What else were you watching last night? Mike, you said you had spent most of your time watching CNN, Fox. What stood out to you aside from John King's institutional knowledge?
They were trying desperately to find a surprising storyline because, as we were saying, a lot of it was predicted. And so at times they were hanging it on fairly thin reeds. But, you know, that Senate race in Virginia was really surprisingly close, for example. The Florida governor's race, I think that was surprisingly close. And there were some other contests that weren't, you know, apparent until later in the evening. And so they tried really every time, you know, CNN makes a projection and these huge graphics would fly out at you in the same way with Fox. So I don't know that they did the best they could knowing what the basic storyline was likely to be.
I mean, it's hard for the news networks to keep the viewers' attention in a midterm election because a lot of it is so local and it's sort of based on in a certain state or a certain region. And people are just going to go off and watch something else that's on TV. I mean, most of what you saw last night, with the exception of, say, The Voice or some of those other shows, were reruns in anticipation that people are going to be watching elections. Well, no, they just turned to another cable outlet and were watching that. I mean, that's mainly what was going on.
Now, what I didn't see, and I didn't expect to see it on the national cable outlets, for that matter, I didn't expect to see it much in election night returns coverage on the local stations, but I really want to see a lot more coverage of what happened around the country in states and in localities. I mean, we had several constitutional amendments in Missouri. We know, most of us who, you know, cared, know how they turned out, but do we know why they turned out that way? Do we know what was going on around the rest of the country? Yeah, there was some sort of, you know, sexy issues like marijuana laws or abortion restrictions or minimum wage or something like that. But there's a lot of other stuff that's probably not as sexy, but things like in Missouri, restricting the governor and what he can do with withholding
or the teacher tenure thing,
allowing prosecutors to bring in prior conviction information in sexual assault cases.
Exactly.
There's a lot of really interesting stuff. And some of it, you know, was kind of contradictory. I mean, here in Columbia, we've also had the taxpayers turning down
police
money for cops and firefighters. But at the same time, we had this Law and Order Yes vote around the state. So these things are not easy to explain, but somebody should try to explain them.
Is that maybe the media not doing the job ahead of time to explain and go deeper into the language? I know that as somebody who isn't necessarily a legal expert, I know I spend a lot of time on my own researching, and the way a ballot measure may be written and put on the ballot may not say what it's actually going to do, so that there's room for a lot of confusion there isn't good education prior to Election Day.
I do think that the media does have some responsibility there, or their lack of responsibility mm-hmm. in doing that sort of makes this a problem, that, and Mike has described it very well.
Yeah.
And I think part of it also is that the fact that with these elections, you have candidates, which create a narrative. And that's easier for journalists to cover that as opposed to some of the murky, not so visually pleasing issues of teacher tenure, or whether or not you're going to vote on an amendment that's going to, or not amendment, but a proposition mm-hmm. that's going to increase your taxes or something like that. You know,
I mean, I will say I was able to find good quality local media stories about some of those initiatives we were talking about. But I still want to have some explanation as to why things turned out the way they did,
and
what that's
going to
mean going
night.
Forward. And that kind of preparation could have been there.
Or that's
but
the
it certainly
story
needs
that gets
to be there
today,
day two, right. day two, day
for
three.
Well, Missouri voters had a new tool launched just in time for yesterday's election. Access Missouri is a collaboration between KBIA, the Missouri Informatics Institute, and the Truman School of Public Affairs here at MU. The site is a portal designed to collect the publicly available data on lawmakers. KBIA News Director Ryan Famuliner told a reporter from KOMU that's the whole point.
The whole point is to really just redistribute it in a way that you would be able to consume it in just a few moments, because that's how much time you get most voters are going to give to any race like this, is maybe 5 or 10 minutes. And if it takes more than 5 or 10 minutes to get the information they want, it's not going to be worth that commitment.
So we've gotten some preliminary information, and Ryan and some of the other staffers at KBIA have told me that since this site went live on Monday, there have been more than 16,000 page views to the site, more than 4,200 unique visitors. That's a lot of interest and a lot of exposure. What's out there that makes this so interesting for folks?
Yeah. I don't know, and I'm really pleasantly surprised at this. Now, I'm a little bit biased. A couple of my students worked with Ryan on this project.
As did some of mine, too.
Of yours. And I think that they found how hard it was to find this data on the legislature, because it was captured in so many different formats, to get it in a way that the public could access it easily. But, you know, these aren't BuzzFeed numbers or NewYorkTimes.com numbers, but that's pretty good. And usually you'd expect a very small group of people would be interested enough that they'd go find this information. And the numbers you did give us were on this past Monday and on Election Day. Can they sustain it? I don't know, but I hope they can, because to be able to track the candidates, the legislators, and know what they're voting on, when they're there and when they're not there, who's giving them money, that stuff's really important.
Well, you know, and one of the other things that I think Ryan pointed out was that a lot of the traffic was being driven by the site being linked to other news sites mm-hmm. out there. And I think that may be the key to keeping this going, is that if the media as a whole begin to use this as an information site that people can go to, I think that that's going to be one of the things that keeps it going.
Yeah, in fact, you could literally just embed the whole thing right in your page. The Columbia Tribune did it. One of the St. Joe television stations did it. Another TV station in St. Louis did it. And so, you know, that's the kind of coalition or network you need to build if you're going to get a project like this to build up steam.
The one concern I have is that, you know, how do you keep this going? Because it takes a lot of manpower.
It's easy to build. Well, I don't want to say it's easy to build, but once you build it, you launch it. And how do you continue to maintain it and keep the data flowing into
exactly,
it?
Exactly. Especially when it seems as if government, and not just in the state of Missouri, but nationally, is not as transparent with this information. It doesn't make it easy for people to go out and gather this, because it's in so many formats, as you said, and it's in so many places. How do you get it all into one area? And it seems like every time that someone puts together an initiative to try to do that and put that initiative into some sort of legislation, it never seems to get anywhere.
Well, I've been saying for a couple of years, one of the things I miss most about living in Chicago is having access to news radio almost on demand. Well, KBIA could be changing that. Made headlines in another story this week as the station and the university announced it is buying KWWC, a low-power FM station from Stevens College. Pending FCC approval, the new frequency will carry classical music around the clock, while KBIA will switch to an all-news format from 4 a.m. to 7 p.m. daily. got really excited when this came, that this news came out late last week. This is a great thing, both for our audience here at KBIA and for our students.
No, I think so. I mean, it still needs to be approved by the Federal Communication Commission.
Right, and that could take a few months still.
It might take a while. But, I mean, the great thing about this is that you could say that everybody's a winner. Classical music listeners, if they're within the right geographical limits, have access to classical music whenever they want it. And those folks who really care about an NPR style of in-depth news, it's not news radio in the classic urban sense, but, you know, really in-depth coverage.
All right.
Then
we're not going to get traffic
too.
And weather together on the 8th.
That's right.
But we are going to get some kind of deeper explanatory journalism that people have become used to listening to both in the mornings and in the afternoons on KBIA. That's not going to stop middays.
And frankly, what I really like about it is the fact that there's an opportunity for the School of Journalism to help KBIA with even new kinds of news content, radio documentaries, a lot of other things that, you know, we haven't been able to do because there hasn't been the time to do it.
Yeah, I think this is going to be a great opportunity for students. And to show them that radio news is still alive, it's flourishing, and here's an opportunity for you to get that kind of experience while you're still in school.
It's alive, it's flourishing, and in many cases, it's expanding with the popularity of podcasts.
Right.
This is an excellent opportunity to create additional outlets. So our next story is one about what hasn't been covered and is raising some questions. It has to do with the visit we had in Columbia this week from the SEC Network. Saturday, the Quad played host to the program SEC Nation. Fans filled the lawn, standing between the makeshift set in the columns, holding signs and cheering. The Missourian published a photo showing two men holding a purple sign that reads, "Standing with Survivors, because athletics won't." I want to read you the caption that appears on the Missourian website with the photo. It says, "University of Missouri students Luke Welsh and Tristan Laughlin hold a poster in support of victims of sexual assault during Saturday morning's live broadcast of SEC Nation on Francis Quadrangle. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and student organization MU Socialists ran events to educate students on the subject. MU Socialist Welsh said, "We also made a Do Green Dots sign because Mizzou temporarily moved the Green Dot banner to an off-camera location." If you were on campus Friday, you would have seen that smack dab in the center of the columns. There was a banner that appeared for the university's Green Dot program. That's the initiative that's designed to raise awareness about reducing physical and sexual violence. So where did the banner go? It moved. Where'd it go?
Well, so there were lots of theories about that. I mean, some theories were that the SEC network or the university didn't want that kind of controversy as part of this feel-good first occasion for SEC Nation to be here on campus. But there was also sort of a much simpler explanation that I saw unattributed in the Maneater, the student newspaper, which was just that the SEC network wanted a better view of Jesse Hall and that banner was blocking it. And if you look at some of the pictures online, you can see exactly why that would be. I'm not saying that simpler, more innocent explanation is the one, but that's as legitimate as the other conspiracy theories about it.
And I think the university should have come out and basically said, this is what we're doing and this is why we're doing it. And that would have, I wouldn't say would have necessarily calmed the waters, but it at least would have provided some sort of explanation as to why they removed the banner and moved it to somewhere else. I mean, exactly where did the banner go? I mean, I'm still kind of wondering.
It moved to another building on the quad. I don't remember exactly which one it is. It was something that was adjacent to Jesse Hall, and it did at some points appear during the program. Okay. But it had been taken down from the columns and moved out of the direct beauty shot.
And whether it was innocent or cowardly, I don't know. I don't know if we'll ever know. But I must say we also should point out that the university has really been extremely vocal and on social media trying to do what it can with regard to sexual violence against students. Even though we obviously were a source of the problem, now it looks like the university is trying to be a part of the solution.
So that's the next point that I want to bring up and talk about a little bit here. One of the things that people may not fully be aware of is the relationship between the SEC network and ESPN. And one of the reasons that this raised my attention is that so many of the issues surrounding sexual violence on campus were the result of the awareness of those issues were the result of investigations that had been done and run by ESPN. And I want to ask you, given the relationship between the SEC Network and ESPN, do they have a responsibility journalistically, after bringing issues to light, to also show what the University of Missouri is doing to attempt to create a better culture here?
Yeah, I think that that's one of the things that not just the University of Missouri, but I think a lot of universities around the country are trying to do is to show that they are doing some things. And if they see ESPN and other networks as outlets to say, we recognize that we have a problem and here's what we're doing to try to rectify that. They aren't getting that kind of coverage. Not the same kind of coverage in what their response to these issues as they were getting when there was an investigation being done by the investigative unit of ESPN and others. So I think that there is going to be a conversation that's going to be had, and it may already be taking place between these various sports conferences and ESPN.
I will say, though, that I think the more important stories that ESPN or anybody else is going to do down the road is to look at the impact of any of these efforts in the university. It's been too soon to really measure it.
Okay, right. Well, let's turn our attention to some other media news. Over the weekend, the Associated Press broke an interesting story about the no-fly zone put in place over Ferguson back in August. The AP got its hands on a Federal Aviation Administration recording that really makes it sound like the police asked for the temporary flight restriction specifically to keep the media away. The AP is reporting that police asked for this because of reports of shots fired at a police helicopter. But if they really were trying to keep the media from getting aerial images, that's a concern, isn't it?
That's a huge concern. I mean, it's one of those things where you don't really know if that was the reason why they were doing it and why they wanted to keep that there, because there were reports that people were firing. Actually, there was a report, one of the police helicopters that reported that someone had fired a laser at the helicopter, mm-hmm. which can actually blind the pilot, and that could be a problem. So you don't really know whether or not. But when you look at the transcripts and you hear those tapes, it does sound as if the police were okay with the FAA keeping the media out, if that was going to be one of the restrictions. Now, the White House yesterday basically came out and said, no, that's not what the FAA was trying to do. They were trying to hear what the police officers were saying, what the police departments were saying, and to act upon any requests that they had made. And it had nothing to do with keeping the media out.
I mean, it seems to me that the AP showed some pretty circumstantial evidence that it was just designed to keep the media away. And if that was the case, it was stupid and it was probably illegal. I also have to say, it seems to me that this shows you the FAA's broader mentality when it comes to favoring, quote, public safety, the perception of public mm-hmm. safety over everything else. They've done the same thing with drones mm-hmm. and the ability for news organizations to use those to show what's going on at protests or in a lot of other circumstances. We can't do that now because the FAA hasn't allowed us to do so. I will say this, though. The news media do have to be careful and think about what the impact of having those helicopters flying low over a potentially explosive situation like in Ferguson can do. People may play to the cameras. The helicopters may incite people. And I just think that the media can't blithely say, oh, we have a right to be there. We are going to be there and we're going to do whatever we want.
And the other thing you have to understand is that when you're watching these images, it looks like that it's a wider area when, in fact, most of this is taking place in a very small, contained area. And if you have a police helicopter and three or four news helicopters,
television stations, it's very crowded.
It's a very crowded area.
Well, technology allows us to do some pretty amazing things. You know, it wasn't all that long ago that Al Franken, now reelected to the U.S. Senate, was playing a reporter going live on Saturday Night Live wearing a satellite dish on his head, as ridiculous as it seemed back then. Today, there are one-man band rigs, not all that much unlike what Franken wore when he was acting. They're called LiveView backpacks, and they use cellular technology to transmit audio and video back to a TV station in real time. The LiveView allows reporters to do things they couldn't do before because they were tied to using big, bulky microwave and satellite trucks. But maybe that wasn't a bad thing. Listen carefully to what this Kansas City reporter says during his live shot describing how a new diverging diamond interchange works.
So they figured to do this diverging diamond interchange. By getting us on the left side, we can turn straight onto the interstate. We don't have to wait at the light, and you'll see it here as I drive up. Now, this was a $9.6 million project. Like I say, they tore down the old bridge back in April. It was 44 years old, so it was a safety issue. They had to do something about it and decided that this might be the best way to remedy the traffic congestion situation in this area. So you see, I could take a left on the interstate. I'm going to continue straight ahead, and I have an orange light. I'm going to go through this orange light here, so that way you can see exactly what it's like, and we go back right on the right side of the road. So a different kind of driving situation for you here in Johnson County, right off of Rome. I'm going to pull off the side of the road, so it's a little safer for me to talk to you here at the camera.
An orange light. A little safer for me to talk to you here with the camera. These driving live shots have become a big thing with the availability of these live view backpacks. We see them a lot during the winter to show how roads are being cleared, but that's not safe.
It's not safe. And although he tried, I will give him credit. I'm going to pull off to the side. I'm sure he didn't think when he said that.
Well, that orange, was after he ran through
when
a red light.
He said the orange light, that it was really a red light. But I mean, here this guy is trying to drive, report, and he's turning the camera back and forth all at the same time. Nobody can do that. And the only reason that we can have a smile on our face and talk about this is because he wasn't hurt and he didn't hurt anybody.
And the road
somebody's going to
empty.
Do that.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those instances, I say this over and over again, just because you have the technology does not mean you have to use it. And this is one of those cases where, as Mike said, this could have been very dangerous. I mean, what if the person next to him you saw the car turn off and go onto the interstate, what if that person had got confused about what they were doing and decided to come over in his lane, and he's in the middle
doing
of that?
Three other things at once.
And then all of a sudden, you know, that description that he's given becomes a very disastrous situation.
On live TV,
exactly. It's just, I don't get it.
Before we go today, a quick word about a National Public Radio favorite. Tom Magliozzi died on Monday at the age of 77. You can still hear him on weekends on KBIA along with his brother Ray on Car Talk. It's a fun show, one I've listened to for years. Click and Clack, the Tappet brothers. They tell jokes, they share laughs, and offer advice to people calling in with their car troubles. Show's been in reruns for the past 2 years, but hasn't diminished its popularity in the least.
No, I mean, we love cars. We love real American originals. We like the DIY ethos. Tom and Ray played into both of those things.
Yeah, I still listen to it on Saturday
and Sundays.
And it's one of those things where you'll be sitting in the car and you just need to get out, but you want to hear the end of it. So I'm really going to miss that.
Too. Well, we're out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics we talked about today on our Links blog. You can find that under the Programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave us comments, questions, see what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, and to Pat Akers for handling the audio. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.